It is Monday, May the 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. Thanks for joining us. Coming up, could Taliban leaders' death affect Afghan peace talks?
The peace process had already been essentially dead, so I don't think that in the short term it will have an impact.
President Obama is in Vietnam, and will he lift those longtime weapons restrictions?
The Vietnamese are asking that he lift the embargo. They're saying, look, we need to stand up to China, which has been increasingly aggressive in the region, on the border and in the South China Sea.
Airline security in light of the Egyptia Air incident, plus the death of renowned country singer-songwriter. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. The Afghan Intelligence Agency has confirmed that Taliban leader Mullah Akhtar Mansour was killed in a U.S. airstrike inside of Pakistan near the Afghan border. VOA's Victor Beatty speaks with RAND Corporation scholar Jonah Blank for his read on the news.
It's very significant, assuming, of course, that the word holds up. But right now we have the United States and the government of Afghanistan both saying, without a whole lot of hedging, that Mansour has been targeted and successfully eliminated, and the government of Pakistan not disagreeing, and the Taliban itself appearing to confirm it. So it looks as if this is pretty solid information. How important is it? Very solid, because this is a decapitation strike. Right now, the Quetta-Shura Taliban has no leader. And it's a very big question, who will take over? Whoever takes over will really determine the course of the Taliban going forward.
Mansour, of course, had been at the helm for just a relatively brief period.
That's true. However, he had been the de facto ruler, or the de facto head of the Taliban, for several years. During the period of several years when Mullah Omar had been, in fact, dead, but had not been publicly acknowledged to be dead by the Taliban, it's believed that Mullah Mansour was actually running the organization. And before Mullah Omar's death, it's quite possible that Mullah Mansour was the de facto leader, even when Mullah Omar was alive but ill.
It must be quite an intelligence coup, given the fact that these high-profile targets are difficult to find.
That's correct. It still is completely unreported exactly how this came about and what it was that led to the targeting. Was this information that the United States had for quite a while but had decided not to act on in the hopes that Mullah Mansour might come and bring the Taliban to the negotiating table? Or was this simply a fast-breaking piece of intelligence that had to be acted on or else the opportunity would go? At this point, we don't know.
Of course, the last high-profile U.S. action inside Pakistani territory that we're aware of had to do with Osama bin Laden back in 2011. How upset will the Pakistanis be?
Certainly much less upset than over Osama bin Laden. The bin Laden raid at Abbottabad was an enormous humiliation because it was a strike not on the border, but right next to the Pakistani military academy in Abbottabad. And that really struck very close to the core. It was seen as just a national disgrace. This is not seen in nearly the same terms. It will be an embarrassment, but not nearly on the level of Abbottabad.
What impact might it have on efforts to get the peace process going with the Taliban?
Well, the peace process had already been essentially dead. So I don't think that in the short term it will have an impact. I think that the United States must have reached the conclusion that Mullah Mansour was not going to move the process forward. Otherwise, the decision would not have been made to target him. But what is very mysterious is why he would have been targeted when one of his potential successors, in fact, the number two leader of the Taliban before his death, Sirajuddin Haqqani, for whom the United States has a $5 million bounty, and who is actually, unlike Mullah Mansour, is actually officially designated as a terrorist.
This also comes just a few days after apparent rapprochement with the Hezbi Islami, a minor militant group.
Yes, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar had been, in fact, a former prime minister of Afghanistan. He'd been a warlord leader ever since the 1970s, and had throughout the 1980s been the warlord warlord leader, the Mujahideen commander, who got the most support from the United States and from Pakistan and from the Saudis. His external patrons started to sour on him during the period between 1992 and 94, when he proved himself just an utterly bloodthirsty figure, even more so than before, and a bloodthirsty figure who could not unify the factions and bring stability to Afghanistan. That was when Pakistan shifted its support from Gulbuddin Hekmatyar to the Taliban.
Jonah Blank is a senior political scientist at the RAND Corporation. He's also author of numerous books, including Mullahs on the Mainframe. Spoke here with VOA's Victor Beatty. Our social media expert, G. Abby Lee, is here with what's being said online about the Mansoor story. Hey, G., what you got?
Hi, Steve. Conservative news outlet Fox News posted its article on Facebook earlier Sunday and received more than 1,500 comments and nearly 2,000 shares. One of the top comments reads like this: "A whole lot of innocent people will not be tortured and killed for no reason. But I'm curious, is it now okay for President Obama to kill the terrorists while he condemned President Bush for trying to do the same?" Nearly 500 people liked that comment.
Any other comments?
Another popular comment was on how the Afghan authorities confirmed that the Taliban has already named a new leader.
And G, did it receive similar reaction to its story?
Not at all. For the television channel, many comments were directed at condemning the Taliban and what they perceive as the Obama administration's lackluster job at fighting global terrorism. To the New York Times Post, people who left comments seem to be more concerned with what they perceive as the Pakistan government's support for terrorism and anti-Muslim sentiments in the West. One of the most liked comments reads like this: 99% of the time, when one sees a person with a turban, they are not Hindus or Muslims, nor genies, and certainly not terrorists. They are Sikhs. That comment seems to refer to past instances where Sikh Americans have been the target of hate crimes. Sikhism originated from South Asia among the Punjab population. Steve, back to you.
And many thanks, G. VOA social media guru G. Abby Lee. You can find G on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman. And you can find International Edition on Twitter at VOA_IE. Among the world's top stories we're covering here on VOA, absentee ballots in Austria's election could determine who'll be the next president. Greece approving new spending cuts, tax hikes as their reforms move forward. Plus, the U.S. presidential poll showing the top contenders locked in a virtual tie. We'll have expanded coverage on those stories plus a lot more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi today announced the start of a military operation to retake the city of Fallujah, held by the Islamic State fighters for more than 2 years. That announcement seemed to clarify that Iraqi forces are advancing first toward Fallujah rather than Mosul, Iraq's second city, which the Islamic State also controls. For some explanation of that strategy and his thoughts on the importance of the operation, VOA speaks with regional analyst Nabil Curry of the Atlantic Council. He's also professor of Middle East and North African Studies at Northwestern University.
It's very important, particularly in that the importance of the city itself, symbolically, historically, geographically, it's close to the capital, Baghdad. And in view of the goal of taking Mosul, hopefully before the end of the year, then you need to clear out anything around Mosul, particularly in the south of it, so that when Mosul is surrounded, there's nothing behind the troops coming back or between now and the launch of an attack on Mosul, that Mosul is not resupplied from Fallujah and elsewhere by fighters and weapons from ISIS. So I would say it's a very important military goal. And it's an ambitious one, but I think that they can do it.
U.S. military, which has hundreds of advisors and trainers in Iraq to assist the Iraqi forces, preferred that Baghdad first pursue an advance on Mosul in the northern part of Iraq, but powerful Iraqi militias deployed to the Fallujah area in preparation for an attack there. Iraq's Joint Operations Command warned civilians in Fallujah, possibly tens of thousands of them, to flee the city. Dozens of families have already fled Fallujah, but Iraqi officials say the Islamic State has sought to prevent them from actually leaving. Human Rights Watch warned last month that the remaining Fallujah residents are facing huge food shortages and exorbitant prices. Still ahead on VOA, President Obama making his 10th trip to Asia since taking office back in 2009. This is VOA.
News happens around the clock. And VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Sali saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. President Obama is in Vietnam 41 years after the end of one of the most divisive wars in American history, and experts say ties between the U.S. and Vietnam have never been closer. VOA's Cindy Sain is traveling with the president and says much of the discussion has been held about lifting an arms embargo.
All eyes are focused on whether or not President Obama will lift the decades-long arms embargo. And the Vietnamese are asking that he lift the embargo. They're saying, look, we need to stand up to China, which has been increasingly aggressive in the region, on the border and in the South China Sea. And also, there seems to be some internal debate within the Obama administration, with some high-ranking people in the Defense Department saying, yes, we need to bolster our ties with Vietnam. It's time to lift this embargo. But the sticking point is really concerns about human rights, which continue to be a concern.
President Obama's visit to Vietnam comes at a time when the Southeast Asian nation is seeking stronger ties with the U.S., in part because of growing tensions with China. There is hope among many Vietnamese Americans, for instance, especially the younger generation. They're optimistic Mr. Obama's trip will further reconciliation between the two former foes. VOA's Elizabeth Lee reports on a generational shift in views on relations between the U.S. and Vietnam reflected in both countries.
Born in Vietnam and brought up in the U.S., Sunny Nguyen co-owns Seven Leaves Cafe, located in the heart of Little Saigon. It's where the largest population of Vietnamese outside of Vietnam calls home. This cafe blends Western design with Asian-influenced food and drink.
Thank you. Thank you.
This fusion reflects most of the cafe's customers, who are generally younger Vietnamese Americans. Many of them are optimistic about President Obama's visit to Vietnam.
I think it's important for any president to go ahead and foster better relationships with different countries.
Back then, a lot of things were different than they were these days. So I think that fostering a relationship with communist country doesn't necessarily mean that it's a bad thing.
This younger generation says it's about mending the wounds of the past, stemming from the Vietnam War and the communist takeover of the country.
We lost everything. So there is, you know, for my parents' generation, it's much more vivid. And those that live here in Little Saigon, it's a scar.
Many in the older generation are doubtful that much will change in Vietnam and even frown at the prospect of closer ties. But the younger generation of Vietnamese Americans has a more hopeful view, says Zong Do, managing editor of Noi Viet, the largest Vietnamese newspaper outside of Vietnam.
With the internet, now with more opportunity, you know, a lot of young Vietnamese people, they went back to Vietnam for charity work. So, and also some take Vietnamese class.
California native Alvin Bui traveled to Vietnam to use his Vietnamese language skills. He explains via Skype.
You connect with other Vietnamese youth in creating a better future for Vietnam, right? So figuring out what they're thinking in their own language, like trying to get in their own head.
Sunny Nguyen also dreams of a better future for Vietnam.
I'm Vietnamese, and I do have a deep care, and you know, and I know Vietnam is still a third world country. Majority of the people are poor, and you know, I want to be able to make a change in the world.
The consensus of the younger Vietnamese Americans here seems to be that Obama's trip is an opportunity for both countries to heal from the past and start a new chapter in history.
There is more of Elizabeth Lee's report from Los Angeles, including some great video. You can find it at voanews.com. From Vietnam, President Obama will travel to Japan for the Group of Seven Economic Summit. While there, he will visit Hiroshima, where the world's first atomic bomb was detonated in combat shortly before Japan surrendered to the United States at the end of World War II. Mr. Obama will be the first U.S. head of state to visit the bomb site. As the search continues for the missing Egypt Air passenger plane in the Mediterranean, where it went down last Thursday with 66 people on board, my colleague Jim Stevenson asked VOA's Michael Bowman about that crash and the reaction here in the U.S.
Typically, when some terrorist group does something, they are eager to claim credit for it. And so it, of course, draws one's attention, this fact that we are days away from the disaster and no one that we know of has claimed responsibility for it. On the other hand, apparently the plane was in some sort of distress for several minutes, and no one has any record in terms of the air traffic control systems in the region of any of the pilots making any sort of comments or saying anything. So this is very much a mystery, and no one knows exactly what has happened to this plane. But this is coming at a time when many U.S. air travelers are already facing waits to board their airplanes, to go through security of an hour, 2 hours, in some cases 3 hours long. Some people are missing their flights. The possibility of some type of new terrorist threat, just as America's busy summer travel season is getting started, the timing really couldn't be any worse.
They aren't kidding when they tell you to get to the airport early because, as you mentioned, the lines are extremely long. And if you're trying to just show up and go, forget it, because it's not going to happen, even if TSA, I think, tries to speed things up.
The Transportation Security Administration, as it's known, is really between a rock and a hard place. Last year, I remember watching hearings on Capitol Hill where the heads of TSA were brought, hauled before Congress, and asked about reports where there were tests done of various security checkpoints around the country, at airports around the country, and fake firearms, fake explosives. Apparently, a large percentage of them pass through without detection. TSA assures the public that those deficiencies have been dealt with, that they have retrained their personnel.
Back to Egypt Air 804. The investigation, of course, is well underway. And I understand they're sending a submarine now to go look for the main body of this wreckage.
And indeed, what they want to find are the so-called black boxes, the flight data recorders, which may provide some real clues and may finally solve this mystery. We have Egyptian officials saying, let's not jump to any conclusions here. Let's not assume it's terrorism. Let's wait and see what we actually learn from the evidence once that evidence is procured. But I have to say that just taking a sampling of the reaction of our lawmakers here in Washington, the attitude seems to be that they're going to assume that it is nefarious intent, evil intent, terrorism, until the evidence proves otherwise.
VOA correspondent Michael Bowman speaking with International Edition's Jim Stevenson. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute. A group of scientists say that if climate change continues at its current rate, Antarctica's Totten Glacier might become so unstable that it could release enough water to produce an almost 3-meter rise in global sea level sometime in the next several hundred years. This same group of scientists from Great Britain, Australia, New Zealand, and the United States previously found warm water is flowing beneath a segment of the glacier, which is causing more melting than expected. If the glacier moves back another 100 to 150 kilometers from its current location, the researchers say the front of the glacier will wind up resting on some unstable geology, setting it on a path of a much more rapid retreat. Once it moves onto the region where the underlying geology is unstable, the scientists say the glacier's melting will be unstoppable and will eventually discharge a great quantity of water that would raise global sea levels by up to 2.9 meters. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Thanks for joining us today. You know, the world of country music has lost one of its great singer-songwriters, Guy Clark. He died after a long illness. He was 74. Nikki Strong of VOA Music came by to speak with International Edition Sarah Williams about Clark's legacy and his impact.
Nikki, tell us about Guy Clark.
Well, Guy Clark was many things. He was a prolific singer, songwriter, and musician who did both country and folk music. He also built guitars as well. He was called a songwriter's songwriter, a poet's poet, who wrote many a hit for the who's who in country and Americana music, including Johnny Cash, Emmylou Harris, Alan Jackson, George Strait, to name a few. Roseanne Cash said she would not be the songwriter she was if she hadn't sat at his table and learned from a master. Many called him a king of Texas songwriters. He was one of the great Texas troubadours, and he has the recognition and awards to back that up. He was elected to Nashville Songwriters Hall of Fame in 2004. In 2005, the Americana Music Association honored him with a Lifetime Achievement Award. In 2014, he won a Grammy for Best Folk Album for My Favorite Picture of You. And I think this is really cool. In 2011-2012, a slew of country artists, including Willie Nelson, Roseanne Cash, Lyle Lovett, Vince Gill, paid tribute to his work in a Grammy-nominated double album set of songs he wrote or co-wrote. And it was called This One's for Him.
Oh, well, he also substantially contributed to the progressive country and outlaw country genres of music that developed in the 70s.
Yes, Sarah. Now, progressive country came out of songwriters rebelling against mainstream Nashville sound. A lot of these genres are, rebelling against Nashville. For progressive country, it came out of songwriters' desire to write for themselves, as opposed to just, like, churning out hits. They were also influenced by rock music at the time. They were impacted by influential singer-songwriters like Bob Dylan, and much of the political discourse of the 1960s. And then progressive country laid the groundwork for outlaw country, which continued to rebel against the commercialization of the Nashville sound and its very clean-cut image at the time. And musically, it drew upon rock and roll as well as honky-tonk and rockabilly. And Guy Clark was very active in both genres.
Even though Guy was a great singer-songwriter, he didn't have the same success as those who recorded his music.
I know, and it's kind of ironic, but not uncommon for that to happen. Guy's recordings of his own songs didn't have the same commercial success. Johnny Cash was one of the first major artists to cover his songs. I know in 1975 he covered the last Gunfighter Ballad. Then later on, Cash did Desperado's Waiting for a Train as a member of the country supergroup, The Highwaymen, which included Willie Nelson, Kris Kristofferson, and Waylon Jennings. And that became a huge hit. And what I find to be funny is he wrote this song called L.A. Freeway, which a lot of artists have covered. It's inspired by the time he spent in L.A. in his early search for fame and fortune before he moved to Nashville. And in the song, he says, if I can just get off this L.A. freeway without getting killed or caught. That's like, and he said after the famous O.J. Simpson Bronco chase, it took him years to be able to sing that line without breaking into laughter. You know, talk about singing about truth. And he also joked that he might have won a Grammy sooner, but he kept losing out to Bob Dylan.
Well, it sounds like he had a great sense of humor.
Yeah. And his narrative rich songwriting, filled with great metaphors and photographic images, really made him one of the most respected singer-songwriters of his generation.
Well, you can hear more music from Guy Clark and other great country singers and songwriters on Country Hits USA with Nikki Strong on VOA 1. If you have any comments, suggestions, or even requests, you can reach Nikki on Twitter at @VOA_music or on Facebook at VOA Music. Thanks a lot, Nikki.
You're welcome.
Like desperados waiting for a train. Like desperados waiting for a train. Like desperados.
Yeah, there wouldn't have been any country western music hardly without Guy Clark. If you've never heard of him, well, he's out there as we just heard. Here's some news for you. British actors Benedict Cumberbatch, everyone knows him, Keira Knightley, Chiwetel Ejiofor, and Helena Bonham Carter. They're among 250 celebrities from the arts world who have signed a letter urging Britons to vote today to remain in the European Union. Some of Britain's best-known artists, musicians, and writers are also signatories in the letter in the Guardian newspaper that warns of the country becoming an outsider, shouting from the wings if Britons vote to leave the EU today. They're holding that very well talked about referendum. How about this? Billboard Artist of the Year this year is Adele. Yes, her album 25 has shot up on the charts. Everybody loves it. And you know what she did? She also got songwriter that is of the year from Britain's Ivor Novello Awards. She's just cooking out there, isn't she? And guess what? Here's another one for you. Cher turned 70. How about that? Whoa, do I feel old. Thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. World News is straight ahead. Hope you'll stay tuned for our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Chaz Hall. I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Sub-Saharan Africa has done well over the past few years. The overall trends in Sub-Saharan Africa point to accelerated democratization, development, and economic opportunity, said Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs Linda Thomas-Greenfield recently before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. A number of countries have ended long-running conflicts and are rebuilding. Others have held successful elections in the past year. Economic opportunities are improving, and per capita income has been increasing steadily. However, in spite of these positive trends, instability and conflict continue to bedevil parts of the continent. And much of that is due to terrorism and violent extremism. Terrorist organizations such as Al-Shabaab, Boko Haram, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, or AQIM, and Al-Mura Batoon are exploiting state fragility and political and economic vulnerabilities, said Assistant Secretary Thomas Greenfield. We see violent extremists focusing their recruitment efforts where there is a lack of economic opportunity, political and social alienation, poor governance, corruption of elites, and lack of accountability for abuses by security forces. In the Lake Chad Basin region, Boko Haram continues its attacks in northeastern Nigeria, Cameroon, Chad, and Niger. In West Africa and the Sahel, terrorist groups have conducted attacks against hotels and a resort frequented by Westerners. In East Africa, Al-Shabaab has launched large-scale attacks against the African Union's forward operating bases and other targets throughout Somalia and Kenya. And ISIL is attempting to co-opt local insurgencies and conflicts to expand its networks. The United States is working with individual countries and transnational organizations in Africa to boost their military capabilities and to strengthen law enforcement, judicial, and other criminal justice sector institutions. At the same time, we are working to stop the recruitment, radicalization, and mobilization of people to engage in terrorist activities. We are expanding engagement with African governmental and non-governmental partners to better understand the drivers of violent extremism and design effective responses. We are working closely with government partners at both the national and subnational level to adopt more effective policies to prevent the spread of violent extremism, said Assistant Secretary of State Thomas Greenfield. The United States is committed to partnering with the people and governments of Africa to promote democracy, peace, and prosperity.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.